You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast. Collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about FIRE, investing, and living your best life. Hey, what's going on, buddy?
Not much, Pat. How you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. So, the most interesting topic that we have this week. I just read your blog post yesterday, and it was very interesting. You were talking about selling your shares and buying a property. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, there's been some confusion about it. The post kind of exploded, as you might have seen that it's only been out for not even 24 hours at this stage and has like 120 something comments, you know, which is absolutely insane.
Yeah.
So,
would that be like the most comments or the quickest number of comments you've ever gotten on a post?
Oh yeah, for sure, without a doubt. So I kind of opened up the conversation and kind of asked people for feedback, because the general idea of the post was that we're in this position of having like a bunch of savings tied up in property and also tied up in shares. And so we were actually thinking of buying a house, which might seem crazy because people kind of think, or they kind of assume from what I've written before that I'm like an anti-property person. But that's not quite true. I usually, because I write a lot about the share market, as you do. But the whole thing is, I've never been anti-home ownership.
Yeah.
I've really kind of suggested that the like simplest and most reliable way for people to get to financial independence was investing in shares. But I haven't said that you can't buy a house or that you should never own property or anything like that. I've basically just said that renting's cheaper most of the time, and people have tortured that into you should always rent and you should never buy.
Dave, you've forsaken us. What are you doing? Here we are. We thought that you were 100% share market, and now you're going to go give it all up to buy a property.
No, so the idea was that later on, like we're renting at the moment and quite happy doing so. But the idea was, as we sell down our properties later, we would use the money that hopefully we've extracted out of those to probably buy a place to live in. So it would just be a case of bringing that date forward, because selling multiple properties kind of in the same state at the same time, and there's just a lot of complexities involved with that in our situation. So shares would have been the easiest option, and although not ideal, we would obviously be building that back up straight away. So that was a kind of the easiest option. But like I said, like it was just supposed to get some thoughts out there of what was going through my mind and see what people's thoughts were. And we had a lot of, you know, like emotional comments from either side, you know, saying that they were very, very pro one side or the other, that I should stick with my regular plan and buy a property later and just wait it out. So the only difference really would be the time frame that I was going to bring forward. And then other people were saying, no, just do it because, you know, you're already in a good position and you can kind of afford it. And worst case scenario, if something happens, you might just have to work part time or whatever. And that home ownership comes with other benefits. So there was a lot of kind of debate on both sides there. So it was interesting to watch. And there's still comments coming in.
Well, this all ties in. I think it was our episode number
3 or 4 where we just talked about home ownership. And I think during that episode, both of us portrayed a more balanced view than people perceive us to have. It's like,
yeah,
it's kind of like rent when it's most convenient, buy when it's most convenient, do... You don't have to like be in one camp or the other. But like you said, when you start bringing up these topics of shares and property, people get incredibly emotional. Like they stick in one camp and it's their band camp and that's it. And it's...
Yeah. And I think you experienced similar thing when you had your ABC article that people kind of twisted that into he's anti home ownership and he, you know,
oh man,
he hates ABC. Property and everything. But we already, as we know now through this podcast, you're actually planning to buy a home a bit later. So it just, some people just, they take a piece of writing and they make a bunch of assumptions or they turn it into something that it's not.
I had nothing to do with the title of that ABC article. Zero.
Yeah.
The original premise was buying in Sydney is crazy because the prices are so high. And it was twisted into Patrick will forego home ownership so he can retire early. I don't know. I suppose if you were making pretzels, that's how you'd make them. But that isn't quite what I said.
Yeah. And with my post, you know, people have taken that stance of me being investing regularly in the share market, you know, over a period of years. And then they're thinking that this decision somehow goes against that, but it doesn't really, because I'd still be investing 100% in the share market. I'm not buying a property for investment purposes. It would be a lifestyle decision or a purchase if we were to do it, you know. It's not I think this area is going to go up in value or something like that. It's just a home purchase. That's all it is. It's not an investment choice.
Yeah, it's an expense. It's like buying a car or buying a TV. You look at what you'll gain out of it and if you're willing to spend the money on it. It has nothing to do with the investment outcomes.
Yeah.
And that's what home ownership is. It's like buying bringing any other piece of property into your life, whether it be a piece of furniture or something or anything like that. It's like, am I willing to spend this money for the benefit I'll get out of it? It's just a much bigger purchase.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And people automatically, like, they can't de-wed the thought of property from investment.
Maybe that's the issue there.
Even people who buy their own homes kind of still, for the most part, I feel, consider them investments. And this whole national psyche is your home is your main or best investment. It's very difficult to de-wed those thoughts, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm.
Yeah. Do you have any more to say on your recent blog post, or should we dig a little further? Are you actually considering selling all your shares?
Well, yeah, the post wasn't, like, I didn't make up the post. The post was like an actual thought that I'd had, you know, but it's still very, like, I'm still very torn about it. I wouldn't take that decision lightly at all. So there's a lot to consider. Did you have any other things you wanted to roast me on today? I might do a follow-up post just to clear up some of the misconceptions or the confusion that maybe people have about our story and our situation and what I've said in the past that has maybe been misinterpreted or something like that.
Mm. No, fair enough. No, but I'm going to watch this space very closely. See what you end up doing. I mean, I find it very hard to imagine a position where I would be comfortable selling my shares to buy a property all in one go. I mean, I understand the position you're in, and it's pretty similar to what I was describing in episode 3 or 4. Like, I want to make sure that I get a home loan before I stop working because I'm lendable, so to speak, at that point in time while I still have a full-time income. And the whole home lending process doesn't really know how to deal with people who are asset rich but income poor. It's so uncommon and unusual that the whole system isn't geared to be able to lend to those sorts of people. It's like, oh, you have no income. It's like, oh, we can't lend you. I'm only borrowing 1/10 of my entire net worth here. Worst comes to worse, I can still I can still give you that money. But that's just not how lenders are geared up to look at these things.
Nah, and you can kind of see why they do it. But then there is other workarounds for people who are, if they're genuinely wealthy and they can pay for it in other ways, there is other strategies, I guess, where they can get lending. But it might be hard with a plain vanilla to a plain vanilla retail banking home loan person who's, you know, just used to mum and dad buying their home with plenty of income. And
you need to get yourself in the sophisticated investor category.
I think you need like a very high net worth to get to that sort of situation. Like I think it's a few million worth.
Yeah, 2.5 million, I think, is when you can get in that category. Mm. But anyway.
I'm not there, mate.
But anyway, for those who don't know, Dave and I record these episodes ahead of time, and so they don't quite line up with when they're released. So we've decided to record this bit and add it to the front of our next released episode, which will be episode 6. After this, you'll hear it cut out, and we'll kind of go into episode 6, and we won't mention this ever again. So it might sound a bit odd that this big event has happened, and we're not going to talk about it again for the next hour, but that's why, because we recorded episode 6 like a month ago or something by the time you end up hearing it. But anyway, I think that's all we got to say. Look at Dave's blog closely for his follow-up article, which I think he's going to try and clear a few misconceptions. And yeah, very interesting topic. And it ties really well into episode 6, which is shares versus property. Yeah, so stay tuned for episode 6. Hey, welcome back everyone to the Fire and Fuel podcast. This time we're going to dive deeper in the two asset classes we mentioned last time, best suited for reaching and sustaining financial independence. So it's important to get a good feel for these assets and what you can expect from them before diving in.
And most of this stuff that we'll mention is stuff that I didn't know at the start of my journey, but I wish I did, and Pat probably feels the same about that. I just really started investing and then figuring stuff out later. I don't know about you. How did you go, Pat?
Yeah, no, exactly the same. And I'll probably just add that that is almost always the best way to do it, because you can spend years trying to learn the best way to invest and you'll end up further behind than someone who just got their feet wet and got in, even if they didn't get it perfect from the beginning. As long as they didn't do anything too diabolically stupid, they probably ended up all right and ahead of someone that just waited till they learnt every fine detail.
And those tend to be the people who never invest, because they're always waiting, always learning, always thinking they need more knowledge or waiting for the best time and stuff like that.
So, yeah.
That's not a great idea.
Yeah. There's no best time and you're never going to learn everything anyway. So get into it when you've got some basic knowledge down pat, and you'll learn the rest as you go.
So we're going to cover the pros and cons of each asset class of property and shares today. And we'll cover how each of us thinks about both of these options. And then, of course, we'll finish with some listener questions at the end. And by the way, thanks for sending those in. We've got tons of them already, so that's awesome. And also an extra big thanks for your support. As we're recording this, it's been a week or so since our launch, and we're really just blown away by the response.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks everyone for that. We really are completely shocked and surprised at the total positive response we've gotten. So please keep it up. Please keep giving us those thumbs up and those subscribes and everything. It was really motivating for us to keep going with this.
And in a complete surprise to us, we actually hit number one in the Apple podcast charts for the investing and for the business categories. How insane is that?
Oh, mate, unbelievable. We got quite a bit of a community response from some pretty famous people out there, and they showed us that we'd hit number one, and so...
I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, I knew they existed, but I didn't even know, like, it was possible to get, you know, high up on there or whatever. Especially for, like, a little fire type podcast.
Well, isn't that great? Like, this small little niche community of fire followers in Australia, which, you know, when I joined in 2017 would have been absolutely tiny. Like, even the Fire Australia Reddit page only had 2,000 people at that point. It may have only started a year before or something. And now the Fire Australia page has, like, 30,000 in that subreddit.
Oh, really?
And yeah. It's crazy. Wow. It's... The Fire Australia subreddit is as big as the Oz Finance subreddit was a couple of years ago.
Ah, okay.
It's really grown, and to get our podcast so high up on the investing and business category in Apple Podcasts just shows how far this community in Australia has come. Thanks everyone again.
All right, so let's get started. So we'll start with the shares category. If you want to kick it off, Pat, what do you think are some of the pros of investing in the share market?
So this is where I like to invest, and this is what I like the most, so I can really be passionate about this. And investing in the share market, super easy to get into with a super low amount of money. You can start investing in the Australian share market with $500 and nothing else. And you don't need to be able to take on any debt to be able to start investing in shares. Very easy to get into. It's very simple and time effective, I'll say, because you don't even need to be able to pick which shares you think are going to perform. In fact, as we'll get into later, it's probably better if you don't try and pick which shares you think are going to outperform, because you can just do what we call index investing. And index investing is buying just the top 200 or 300 shares in Australia. And you can do all of that in a single trade. And that gives you basically, I think it's 80% of all of the companies in Australia in a single trade with as little as $500. That's great. And it doesn't just stop at Australian companies. You can also do the same with the top 1600 international companies. A single trade, you can own all of them, and that's roughly 70 to 80% of the entire world's stock market owned in a single trade.
It doesn't really get much easier than that, does it?
Oh, it's impossible to get easier than that. It's so simple, it's so cheap, and like I said, you don't need to have thousands and thousands of dollars to get into it. So it's great.
Another benefit to me is the limited amount of monitoring and research that's required. It's not something you need to kind of keep on top of. There's very little admin required. I mean, you're just going to get one or two, maybe whatever dividend statements per year that you fill out on your tax return. And that's pretty much it. So it's just super hands off, super passive.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Because when you buy shares in a company, you're not just buying the company. You're also paying for the total management of it. There's a whole board of directors and a whole management structure are all focused on driving the best outcome for that company and for their owners, which ends up being you as the shareholder.
Yeah, exactly. So you're the owner, so that everyone is essentially working hard for you.
Yeah.
As small as your ownership might be, it's very, very real.
Yeah, that's right. And like you said, you just get one letter a year or something like that. Tells you, oh, look, this is how much you've earned. And these are the little numbers you put on your tax return.
And like you said, you can achieve huge diversification at very little cost or effort by even buying one fund, like you mentioned, Pat.
It's amazing. And it's even better than I described, because I described buying two funds for each of Australia and international. But even that might be too complicated for some people. Fair enough. Who wants to waste their time looking at two different funds and dealing with two different sets of data to input into your tax return? You can actually buy a single fund from Vanguard, and that will include all of the Australian companies, all of the international developed markets, all of the international emerging markets, and bonds, all in a single trade with as little as $500, which is just insane. You couldn't have imagined being able to do that even 50 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to wrap your head around how far it's come and how easy it is for the everyday person to get involved and have such a large spread of ownership of different companies with such little effort at such low cost.
Yes, and just like it is so much easier today in 2020 to be a successful share investor than it was even 20 years ago. Yeah, even though index funds have been around since I think 1970, they haven't really been around in Australia until the early 2000s. Amazing stuff. Love it.
And so another benefit of the share market is, of course, dividends, which is really collecting income in a relatively effortless way, whether it be quarterly or every 6 months. Those companies that you own will send a sliver of cash your way and essentially say, hey, here's some of our profits. Enjoy.
They just hand you out cash.
And in Australia, Aussie companies that pay tax here, the dividends will also come with franking credits, which essentially means that you'll get a credit for the tax that the company has already paid on that money.
Yeah.
And so that helps reduce any tax owing on your dividends. And if you're a low income earner or you're in retirement, you'll even receive a refund for those franking credits.
Yeah.
Currently.
Currently, yeah. Was it last year when the Labor government was proposing to scrap the refund? Anyway, take it while you can get it, but don't rely on it, I say.
It's a bonus.
Definitely a bonus. And of course, the great thing about investing in companies, and this should be true of anything that you decide to invest in, it should produce something that is of value to humans. So companies, they, through their work and their endeavor, they produce stuff that humans will buy, and that is where all of the growth and the growth in the company value and the dividends come from, as opposed to something like gold, which basically does nothing. You can expect gold to not change in value. Basically, it will only ever go up with inflation over the very long term. It's volatile in the meantime, and people can make money off that volatility, but it's not really investment so much as a hedge or a speculative buy.
But with the share market, you're essentially harvesting the return from productive businesses and the innovation of society over time.
Yes. And to be fair, that's exactly how the capitalist market was designed to work. You reward people for investing and working on things that will benefit humanity. This is just the design of capitalism in function, working how it's meant to work. But what about the cons of investing, or investing in shares, I should say? Why would we not want to invest in shares?
All right. So probably the most obvious thing that stands out to most people, and you won't even have to think about it, is the volatility of the share market. And that's enough to put most people off it entirely. Like, you just see the seemingly random swings and, you know, massive ups and downs, and you just think, no, that's not for me. That's not a place I want to invest my money, because it doesn't seem like it makes sense, or it doesn't seem reliable. So why would I invest there?
Yeah.
That's how I think a lot of Aussies and a lot of everyday people think initially. And that's definitely how I thought in the beginning too. So that's why I opted for property investing in the early days. And we can get into that a little bit later. Mm. But it's really these fluctuations that really unnerve people. And that's really a thing that's off-putting.
Yeah, well, they think it's a casino, don't they? And I thought it was a casino before I decided to do even the smallest amount of research on it. which wasn't just what my uncle was telling me at family barbecues.
Mm. Well, you look at, someone will mention, oh yeah, like shares are fine, but what about the GFC? Mm. And so me and you, like we lived through the GFC, but I don't know about you, but I wasn't investing then. I was quote, investing in a high interest savings account at the time, which was actually not too bad, you know. I don't know if you were you invested during the GFC, Pat?
No, not at all. I was just starting university, and any spare money I had was just burnt, yeah, on beer or food or whatever it may be. So wasn't investing through the GFC, so I can't say that I've experienced a market shock of that magnitude before.
So we can chalk that one down as somewhat of a con that puts people off. And even if there's some upside to it in terms of opportunity, it's still something that is unsettling enough that it can be put into the cons category, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So, of course, people also don't like that when you invest in shares and companies, you basically have no control over the companies. It's all outsourced to CEOs and boards and management. You need to sort of be comfortable with the fact that you can't control the outcome of it. You're just dumb cash, so to speak. You put your money in and you expect a return. As we were saying, I kind of consider that a positive. I suppose for some people, it's definitely a negative. They'd like more control over their investments.
I guess there's a level of trust that has to be inbuilt there where you're investing your cash in these companies. There's a level of trust that, you know, the CEOs and management is going to do the right thing. They're not going to waste that cash. They're not going to agree to insane bonuses. You know, we've all heard stories like that, you know, about the fat cats rewarding themselves for a company that might even be declining and they're still getting bonuses. So yeah, there's an element of trust there that you have to accept things like that, because those are things you don't control.
It's also quite easy for people to invest in hot stock speculative mining companies. They want them to find the next batch of gold in the desert or something. It happens.
the next mineral that's going to change the world.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy to do the wrong thing when investing in the share market. It's much easier to go wrong in the share market than it is to go wrong in, say, other investment classes, which we'll speak about later on.
Because if you pick a few companies that go to zero, you know, that's 100% of that investment gone. That can happen. Like, yeah, there are ways to mitigate that, but that can definitely happen if you're choosing your own stock. That's unlikely with property. You know, property's not going to really go to zero.
No, well, that's sort of the thing. In the share market, there's, again, more volatility of returns. So it's easy to do the wrong thing in the share market, whereas in property, even if you do the wrong thing, you'll probably still end up okay. You know, you're not going to go to zero and be absolutely destroyed.
And that's extremely comforting for some people, I think.
Yeah. Except with debt, but we'll get to that later, because debt can destroy even the most robust portfolio of property if you use it wrong.
We'll let you rant about debt in a minute, Pat. Just hold on a minute, all right, mate?
That's not yet. That's for later on in the episode.
So just back to those, I guess, speculative type investments. We're saying how you can lose 100% of your money, and that's a bad thing. But it can also be a bad thing if you get it right, because you'll think you're a genius. You'll think that, this investing in the share market is easy. I chose this penny stock. You know, I bought it for 2 cents. Now it's at 20 cents. You know, look how smart I am. And so you start putting bigger and bigger amounts in, thinking that you've got some secret recipe for minting cash in the market, you know. And sometimes that can be your downfall, because it was luck and it wasn't actually based on skill and actually proper research. You know what I mean? So sometimes that can be,
absolutely, that
can be a bad thing.
Yeah, people build up their confidence with what were, at the end of the day, just lucky picks. Then they, you know, pour in their life savings and they get it wrong and boom, it's all gone.
But then they'll just think they're unlucky.
Yeah. Not that...
And then, oh, it's rigged. It's rigged against me because my cash machine stopped working.
They'll rationalize it some way.
And we have to remember that the share market is a market full of professionals. So it tends to be hard to out-research, to out-think, to, I don't know, out-maneuver people who are doing this for a living all day, every day. They live it, they breathe it. Are we really any better at figuring out what the good companies are than the market is? I don't know about that.
The answer is no, you're not. That's very simple. And you're right. It's, some people don't understand the mechanics of the share market. But basically, when we say you're against all those professionals, you really are. Every single trade has a buyer and a seller. Every single stock is undergoing an auction all the time the market's open. And it's an auction on the buying side and on the selling side. So there's bids going up and down on both sides.
If you're buying something, someone else is selling it. So why are they selling it? You know?
That's right. And then there's 10 bidders trying to sell it. So there's 10 different sellers trying to see if they can sell it. And there's, you know, 10 different buyers. And sorry, 10 is a very small number. That's actually hundreds or thousands for some shares. Like you said, there's all of these professionals all buying and selling at the same time as you're trying to buy or sell. And that just means that it's a very efficient market, but it also, being very efficient, means that all the information is there and all the professionals are putting the information in the market to get to the right price. So your chances of beating that or finding an arbitrage in that are breathtakingly low. They're just disappearingly low.
It's funny because people have these conversations like, oh, I think X is going to do well over the next 10 years, you know, because of some trend that's obvious to everyone. It's like, well, yeah, everyone already knows that, you know.
And the thing is, even if a company does do well, even if you're right and company Tesla grows another 10 times, everyone already knows that. And everyone has already bid up the price to reflect that expectation. So the return is still just going to be average, because that's what happens when people bid up prices. They bid it up until there's better opportunities elsewhere for better than average returns.
It's a good point, and it's a little bit counterintuitive, because you think, well, this company has a bright future, therefore it will have better returns, but it's not that simple.
That
future return is usually baked into the price already, sometimes too much so.
Yeah, correct. You can almost say that looking at how a company is going to do will tell you nothing about how the share price is going to do, because there's more baked into the share price than just how the company is going to do.
All right, let's move on to property, and we'll start with the positives. So what are the pros of investing in property? And obviously by this, we mean residential property, as obviously this is the most common choice for everyday people. We don't mean commercial property here, just the average rental property. So the first point that everybody mentions is, of course, leverage. With property, you can use large amounts of leverage and you can buy a relatively expensive asset with only a small amount of money down. And so the gains tend to be magnified. So are the losses, but the gains tend to be magnified.
Mm.
Some people would say, like, you know, if I buy this house, I put 10%, 20% deposit down. And then if that property grows by a bit, the return I've made on the equity I put in is huge, you know, because I only put, I don't know, 100 grand in and the property's grown by X amount. So my return is amazing. How good is that? But it's not that simple, and I'll talk about this in a minute.
Like you said, it happens on the way down as well. You magnify your losses. It's just that everyone forgets about that because, again, Australia has just had this magic property run for so long. I keep saying Australia, but it's not even Australia. It's just the East Coast. The East Coast has had this magic property run for so long that it almost doesn't enter the psyche of the average property investor that the prices could go down, and then instead of the leverage being a benefit, it's actually really working against you.
Mm.
But sorry, I was meant to only be doing pros of properties. But here we go.
just wait.
Keep getting ahead of myself on this episode. Another advantage is you can add value yourself. You know, if you're a tradie or a contractor and you have some sort of idea of what you're doing, you can improve the property in some way. And even if you aren't a tradie or contractor, just by putting some sweat equity in, as long as you don't screw it up too bad, you can definitely improve the property over time. And you might actually enjoy doing that sort of work. It could be a double benefit because you're doing stuff you enjoy on the weekend and you're improving the value of the property you're in.
Mm, you definitely can't add value in that way with the share market, can you?
No, definitely not. This is probably one of the greatest benefits, I'll say. It's especially if doing sort of woodworking and renovations in your spare time is something you enjoy. I'm not sure how many people will actually enjoy it. I think a lot of people think it's enjoyable by looking at all the Instagram and the YouTube
TV,
and the TV.
TV shows, yeah.
Yeah. People... The problem is all of those TV shows are like squished into an hour or so. So you only see all the best bits.
Half the time it's people sitting around drinking coffee, chatting and bickering and whatever. It's not actually like 8 hours, 10 hours of hard work on the show.
No. Half the time they're drinking coffee while there's a team of contractors in the back doing all the work. A lot of the people that look at those reno shows have never, like, sanded a single door for 3 days straight, you know? Let me tell you, once you sand a door for 10 hours a day for 3 days in a row, you understand that just how much effort and work has to go into construction. It's definitely not as easy or as quick as TV shows make it out to be.
Not as glamorous either.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. But right, I like this one. I actually do like that one as a pro for property.
What else? Okay, so it's a real asset that you can see, you can touch, you can control it as well. You can't do that with the share market. You can even move into it if you want. You definitely can't do that with your shares. I think this point doesn't do much for me as a positive, but many people I know really appreciate this emotional factor and how tangible and whatever properties that they can move into it if they want to, and there's a sense of security that goes along with that.
You can understand that because of all the investment scams you see online and you see like A Current Affair talking about. I suppose when you and me talk about the share market and Vanguard and index funds, to the layperson that's indistinguishable from, you know, capital trust investment shipboat containers on, you know, I don't know, that they just see online or something.
Well, it's because it feels digital. It doesn't feel real.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they connect these squiggly prices that move every day with digital money that's not really, doesn't feel real. And you're like, well, no, I'm not comfortable with that at all.
No, well, precisely. And like I said, how is someone meant to distinguish between what is actually a very good and responsible investment, like a share market index fund, versus some other advertisement on YouTube or on Facebook or something saying basically the same things we're saying? Oh, diversified, good income, good long-term returns. It's very difficult. So like you said, there's the security of, oh, look, I can see the house.
I know the house is there. I know I'm not being scammed by some fake Ponzi scheme or pyramid scheme. That's enough for most people. It's like, I'm not going to risk my money with something I can't physically look into and understand and make sure I'm not getting scammed.
That's a good point. I think there's an extra, layer, extra sense or extra layer of transparency there.
Yeah.
They're more convinced and more certain that this is a real asset. I know exactly what I'm buying.
And like I said, that's a hard one to get over. Like, how do you convince your everyday person that the share market or this, what we're saying in terms of index share market investing, isn't just the next scam on the table, that it is the long-term thing?
The first thing that comes to mind for me is, if you buy your groceries at Woolies, is that not a real business?
Yeah, who's
your home loan with? Commonwealth Bank? Like, you know what I mean? That's the kind of examples, like, they're real businesses.
Yeah, but are you actually selling them those businesses? How do they know that what you're telling them is true about Vanguard owning all these businesses? What happens if it's just some charade to fleece you of your cash? How do you prove that?
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's an element of trust there, I guess, in the system.
And I can understand that because you and I, we're probably very comfortable with computers. We're very comfortable with the share market. We know what we're getting into. But there's a whole group of people out there that aren't that comfortable with all of these things. And they do watch A Current Affair and see people getting scammed on the regular. So that can definitely scare them away from something they can't physically see and touch and know is real.
Good point. The next point that we want to make about the property market and the pros of it is that you could call it an inefficient market. And by that, I mean that it's mostly the people that are buying and selling houses are mostly just everyday people who are moving house. I mean, most houses are owned by owner-occupiers. They're a larger part of the market. And they're not professionals, you know, they're just buying and selling homes that they want to live in. So they're often making quite an emotional decision, and there's room for negotiating the price between the buyer and the seller. You definitely can't do that with shares. Like, the price is the price and it's moving and you have no control over that movement. Whereas with a property, you may be able to negotiate a better deal, whether you're buying or selling. So you might be able to get a bargain, or you might be able to sell for more than you initially expected because of these factors.
Yeah. Inefficient market. Like, a property could be up for sale this week and it could have 10 people wanting to buy it. It could be up for sale in 3 months' time and there's just no one interested in that sort of property at that time. So we like to speak about the property market in averages, but in reality, every home is unique. Much, much more so than a share in a particular company. Shares are completely repeatable and replaceable. So they aren't unique, whereas properties are unique. So you can get that sort of inefficiency creeping in.
And then the last pro, I put this in as a pro. I don't know what you reckon, Pat, but the last pro is you get to brag about big numbers at your local barbecue. So like, my house went up by $100,000 in the last 3 years.
You're just taking you get the to piss talk now, bigger right? numbers.
Oh, I thought you'd like this one.
That's a great pro, man. That's exactly why I'm doing this whole investment thing.
But that's what people do. They like the big numbers associated with property. In theory, it's much easier to make a six-figure gain through owning a home or an investment property than it is getting started in the share market. It's going to come. Yeah, there's more to it, but they can see that gain is logically more possible sooner because of the larger numbers involved.
Yeah, yeah.
And Pat, obviously you're in Sydney and that's all everyone does, isn't it? Just have barbecues and talk about how much their property went up in value?
I don't know. I'm not you don't get invited to those right ones. Crowd.
They've stopped inviting you to those, haven't they?
Oh yeah. I'm just a killjoy at those sorts of discussions.
Ah, and so in Perth, people do the opposite. We drink together and drown our sorrows, and we tell tales of how much the price of our property and the rent have fallen over the last 5 years.
It's mind-boggling. I can't even imagine it.
So yes, I was somewhat taking the piss with that last
part. But that just shows, it's all possible. You know, prices can go up and they can go down, and those six-figure returns can also be six-figure losses with leverage.
Well, I think we're just realizing that now, like in Perth and Sydney, has been a very different 10-year period. Mm. And it's been, especially in Perth, has been a very unusual 10-year period. If you look at the history of residential property in Australia over the last, I don't know, 50 years, 100 years, it would have seemed unlikely that prices would go nowhere or maybe even be lower 10 years later or 12 years later.
Completely unlikely.
Yeah.
But no one believed this.
No, of course not. I mean, well, it's just showing that this both outcomes are possible, even for a capital city. So just something to keep in mind.
We've kind of mixed in the cons and the pros. Like, we couldn't help ourselves. Sorry, everyone. But we are actually meant to move on to the cons of property now.
And it's my turn to rant today. You've heard Pat rant a few times, and this time it's my turn.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave. I'll give you the floor.
All right. And so I'm the one of us who actually, it might sound strange, but the one who's going to rant about property is the one who actually owns property. But I just want to mention some things maybe in a little bit more detail that are either rarely mentioned or they're glossed over. Number one, the costs to get started tend to be extremely high, and most people will be pretty aware of this. And so this means that you'll need a fairly hefty deposit to get started, unlike with, you know, the share market where Pat mentioned earlier, where you need $500 really to get started. Stamp duty will be quite a large amount unless you're a first home buyer, but we're talking really about investing today. The ongoing costs are very high as well. So we covered all those costs in our housing episode. Mm. The long list of them, if you want to listen to that. And then, of course, you can add more wear and tear to that, because you tend to find more wear and tear in a rental property than owner-occupied property. And, of course, you can throw management fees on top of that as well. So there's more costs to be aware of.
Yeah, and we're really talking orders of magnitude apart. In share market, $500 to get started. In property,
50 grand maybe.
What are we talking? Yeah, 50 at the minimum. You're getting a shit box like for 50 grand. What
are you doing? I mean deposit. That's a deposit.
Well, talking about stamp duty, deposit plus buying costs just to get into property. What are we talking about? 50k? 60?
It depends on how much loan you want to use. You can get 90% loan or something like that. So
yeah,
I think you can still even get 95% loans.
Yeah, great. Just dial up the risk so you can get in with a lower amount. That's great.
I did that. That's what I did back in the day.
Yeah, when property could only go up. Yeah,
exactly. What could go wrong?
What could go wrong? Yeah.
Another thing is that the admin is really a pain in the ass, to be honest. Like, if you go down this route of property investing, assuming you're doing this, you're not just going to buy one property. You're going to buy multiple properties. And that means multiple things that will need fixing. And there's emails associated with managing those properties. Even if they're outsourced to a property manager, you're not forever getting emails, but it's like a steady stream, you know, on and off of, oh, this needs fixing, this one's moving out, and all the rest of it. And obviously the costs that come along with that. And then you've got to deal with banks and your mortgage, and there's loan contracts and that in the beginning. So there's definitely much more administration with property. And I don't know about you, Pat, but to me, the return outlook is not that great looking forward over the next couple of decades versus the last, what we've experienced in the last few decades, thanks to like rapidly falling interest rates and this move to dual income households instead of just one spouse working. Now we've got both spouse working most of the time. We can't really repeat those tricks again in the future.
I try my best not to get into the weeds of trying to predict how property prices can go up. But every time I look at it, I think the same things. It's like property prices have had this huge tailwind of dropping interest rates, more women entering the workforce, and a lot of immigration into the country. The only way we're going to get similar tailwinds is, I don't know, extending mortgage timeframes from greater than 30 years, which they are now. So if banks can manage to issue 40 or 50 year mortgages, or if we have more intergenerational housing, so you start a loan and your kids end up paying it off. And I don't think there's a lot of space to go for housing to continue to shrink. So housing has shrunk to the absolute limits in Sydney anyway. And I don't think you're allowed to shrink it any further than some of the shoeboxes I've seen. But yeah, where is the increase in housing prices going to come from? Everyone's already at their borrowing limits. And those are the only places I can see. And they're not guaranteed to come to fruition.
It'll be hard to juice it much from here, but I don't think it's unreasonable to expect property to grow in line with like wages, maybe a little bit higher. What's that going to be? Maybe, I don't know, 3% per annum?
Something like that.
Yeah, I don't think that's unreasonable.
No.
I don't know about you, but I'm not a housing bear at all. I think property might do okay, but I just don't think the future is like the past at all.
I'm not sure.
Are you a bear? Come on, Pat. Just lay it out on the table now.
No, I'm a hopeful bear, I'll say. I want to believe in the bear story. I really do. Okay. Because I do want to buy a house. When you dig into it, I always come to the same thing. I just don't know, and I can't know. I don't want to pretend like I know, even though I wish I did know, and I wish it did go down. But it's hard to say. This whole coronavirus thing, let's see where it pans out. Let's see when the government pulls away the job seeker and the job keeper. Let's see when the banks pull away their, you know, 6-month leniency periods. What's going to happen? Because right now that's holding it all afloat. That's just keeping it up there.
And so you got to remember as well that rental yields in our capital cities are relatively low, and after costs, they're very low. So if the growth outlook isn't great and the income picture also isn't great, then the overall returns aren't that exciting. And so just to get into the numbers a little bit more, the numbers really aren't as good as most people think. And so let's talk about leverage for a minute. Nobody seems to mention this, but let's say you start with a 20% deposit on a house, and we'll assume that there's no negative cash flow associated with your investment property. If you buy a $500,000 house and let's say it grows in value by 3%, you've made $15,000 worth of growth. And if you had that 20% deposit, that means you put $100K in. So you made $15,000 worth of growth on your $100,000. So you earned a 15% return. Like, that's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, that's great.
So let's take it forward a little bit. So if we go into the future, assuming all goes well, maybe the house ends up being worth $600,000. If it grows again by 3%, that'll be $18,000 in that year of growth. So that might sound like an 18% return, but it's really not, because now you have $200K sitting in the house because it went up by that $100K. So if you got $200K sitting in there and you earn $18,000 of growth, your return on your equities are actually only 9%. That's a big, big drop. And so nobody really mentions that. They just think, oh, well, this leverage magnifies my return. And they seem to think it magnifies it forever, but that's not really true. At this point, you may have a small amount of positive rental cash flow, but it won't make all that much difference. So what am I trying to say with this point? Really, to sustain a high return from property and to have your equity, your return on equity be very high, means you need to stay highly leveraged forever. So as your equity in the property grows, your return on equity falls every single year. And so if you want to stay highly leveraged forever, that essentially means you'll have to keep working forever. And I don't really think anybody wants that. And that's probably not the idea they have when they go into investment property. So that means to retire, you'll need to sell your properties and turn that equity into cash flow somehow, which means you'll have to make some pretty hard selling decisions. And some people wear their, you know, property portfolio as somewhat of a badge of honor. And it's something they definitely don't want to sell down, but they'll almost need to if they want to achieve any sort of income to live on. So then you'll be hit with capital gains tax, agents fees, and you have to invest large lump sums of cash, which can be pretty stressful. I'm in this situation myself, but our properties haven't done that well. But yeah, it's still not an enjoyable situation to be in.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to add there, Pat?
No, I think that's a pretty good summary, Dave. Yeah, just sort of like you said, it just paints the picture. It's not an unlimited cash machine. It's as long as you keep yourself on that knife's edge of extreme leverage, then you can keep up the really good growth. And hopefully the market keeps going up while you've got those huge loans out. But as you said, if it doesn't grow, then you're basically paying interest on a neutral or negative cash flow property and making no growth. So,
and well, like we said, there's been periods, especially in the recent couple of decades, but even over the long term, there's been periods where property is flat for 5 years. Like, that's quite common. And so you got to remember another thing too. Because of those startup costs, you're probably paying maybe 4% or 5% in stamp duty and whatever the other costs are.
Conveyancing, building pest inspection. Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah. I've never bought a property, but there seems to be a few little bits and pieces that add up to a few $1,000s as well.
Yeah. So once you've got those startup costs, and then there might be some negative cash flow for the first couple of years, that means you're really just, like, the first few years, if you get a bit of property growth, it's going to take a little while, a couple of years, just to break break even, let alone to make your first dollar of return.
Yeah.
A lot of people gloss over that point as well. And if you hit a quiet patch, like I just said, 5 years of flat prices is not uncommon. If you hit a quiet patch, then you're looking at maybe 7 years before you even make a single dollar. That's a fairly long time. You have to be pretty patient.
Yeah, just to overcome all those initial costs and to overcome the selling costs. If you do decide to sell down the line.
Like, well, that's right. It adds to your hurdle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it can make you money in the long term, but you just have to deal with all of that negative cash flow and all of that initial costs and exit costs to get there.
And so for your time frame, like we're talking about financial independence here, so if your time frame is anything like 10 years, it's a long time, but it might not be enough to eke out a strong gain after all these costs are involved and you may hit a quiet patch of growth or get unlucky. So that might not even be long enough.
Yep. Agreed.
Another point is that the price index that we see for property is actually skewed. It doesn't account for new buildings and renovations. Like if you renovate your house, it might be worth 30 grand more than before.
Yeah.
And then if you sell it, that's accounted for in the price data. But nobody, it's not accounted for that you tipped in 25 grand to renovate the house.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Only the higher price is recorded. So it looks like property's growing when it's just more expensive houses. That's not the same thing.
Well, yeah, precisely. It's like, oh yeah, property has gone up by 10% this year. Meanwhile, people have spent, you know, the equivalent of millions and millions of dollars on their properties to renovate them and build new ones and do all that. And like I said, that disappears into those averages. And no one, you can't really account for them in any meaningful way on an average price growth graph.
And finally, the tax benefits are somewhat overrated. I mean, there's of course negative gearing, which tends to be touted as a tax benefit, but that's really just an outcome of the way you finance the property. And you can negatively gear with shares as well, so it's not unique to property. Mm-hmm. But the main tax difference I think people get confused with is they say, well, okay, well, there's tax benefits for shares, which are franking credits, but there's also tax benefits for houses, which is depreciation. Those, if we think about it, those two things are not the same thing. Franking credits are a tax credit. Depreciation is a tax deduction. One is actual cash in your pocket. The other one is just a tax deduction, which reduces the amount of tax you have to pay. It's not the same thing. One's a cash benefit, the other's a paper benefit.
Yeah.
Plus, depreciation actually implies a future cost because the property is literally wearing down over time. It's deteriorating every single year. So that's, you have to account for that and need to, you know, replace and maintain and upgrade the property over time. And people say, yeah, that's okay because I can, you know, I can renovate the property and get higher rent and I'll add value and whatever. But you need to do those things just to keep getting rent at all. If you don't maintain your property, you're not going to have a tenant. So you have to maintain it just to keep getting any rent, let alone market rent, let alone increase the rent faster than normal growth. So it's not even optional, you know?
Yeah. Again, just one of those costs that's sort of brushed aside. It's like so small and trivial, people don't consider it, or they consider it small and trivial, so ignored.
I think too many people just take the positives at face value without like digging in a little bit deeper and like, well, what does that actually mean in practice? And
yeah. It all sounds good. It's all, like you said, barbecue talk. The uncle has got many properties. Everyone's like, oh, you should get into property. I've heard it's a good investment. It's like, oh, have you now? Okay.
Everyone knows, Pat. You're missing out.
Yeah. Where'd you read that? Oh, realestate.com.au. Oh, of course. They know best.
Oh, my real estate agent sent me a docket that says property's going to grow by 20% next year.
We better get in now, Dave. Coronavirus hits. Property's still in good position to keep growing. 3.5 million people now receiving JobKeeper. No. It's all okay. Property will still grow. It's like, okay. The endless optimism of real estate agents never ceases to surprise me.
Well, it's like that old saying, like, you don't ask the barber if you need a haircut.
No.
So you definitely don't ask the real estate agent whether it's a good time to buy property.
It's always a good time.
So in case it wasn't obvious, we're now going to talk about what we choose to invest in and why. So do you want to go first, Pat?
Yeah, okay. So I'll go first. This isn't going to surprise anyone. I've been investing since I've had money to invest. I've invested in the share market. At the very beginning, I really didn't know what I was doing, so I was just getting my feet wet. But over time, I have learned a lot more, and I've really driven the way I invest toward a more internationally diversified portfolio of shares, which is doing really well for me. One of the greatest things I like about investing in the share market is I maintain zero debt, and I maintain the greatest amount of flexibility, and I'm very robust to financial shocks. Not that I've actually experienced any as up to now, I could say. The fact that I am so robust just leads to a super low stress life for me compared to what I'd say are sort of over-leveraged property investors. I'm cash flow positive. I've got my job. If I lost my job, I don't have to worry about all of these investment property loans that I have to keep servicing. And it's just been great. You know, I don't have that overlying level of I'll say it again, stress just always worrying me. Well, and these investments are still, you know, positive, and the investments are going to be good investments regardless of the tax policy and regardless of interest rate movements. Like, I don't have these extra things in the background that could make these bad investments one day because the macroeconomic environment changes. So again, easy, low stress. All I have to do is buy them. If I need money for any reason and I can't buy shares, it's not like a mortgage. I can just stop buying them momentarily, do what I need to with that money. If I want to take an international holiday, spend $10,000, $15,000 doing it, I just don't buy shares those months. I take that holiday and get right back to it when I get back. So great flexibility, great robustness, financial stability, and less stress. And it works beautifully for me.
I think you made a good point on because the portfolio is funded entirely by cash,
yep.
There's only positive returns being delivered to you in the sense that there's no money coming out of your pocket, essentially. So if your circumstances change in any way, that portfolio is always going to be delivering you some sort of positive level of cash flow because it is funded not by debt, but by cash savings. So that's a good point to remember.
Yeah, I don't need to worry about the whole debt thing, and I'd prefer not to worry about it. So I'm very happy with that. And I'm in my young 30s now, and I've never had to worry about a huge amount of debt. It's great.
Well, my situation is a lot different. So I think I've already explained this, that I started investing in property from the beginning. But later I just realized that shares were going to be a better way to create income to live off. Because as we've said before, even if your property is paid off, the income is very low and there's just so many expenses associated with it. So just the hassle and the costs involved. And I just find shares is much simpler. It's easy to diversify and there's nothing really required of me. I mean, I just put money in and I get sent some income every quarter or whatever it is. There's really nothing to do, you know. It's very, very laid back and very simple. Like the companies are working hard and everyone else is working hard except for me. So I like that. And I just learned a few valuable lessons along the way that, like, I shared some of those today, where I just realized that property is not as good as many people assume. And so these days I tend to invest our cash into shares. And we'll do for the foreseeable future.
And you know what, Dave? I can't believe we didn't cover this in the cons of property section. But if I could just bring us back there for a moment. Like, sorry. When you invest in property, your amount of diversification is essentially zero. Like, you have no diversification. You've brought a single property on a single street in a single suburb in a single country of the world. It's like, if that's maddening low level of diversification compared to investing in shares. So if that street gets flooded, your investment doesn't perform. If, you know, a crack house opens up, you know, down the street, your property goes down in value. If there's some structural damage, oh shit, that fucks up your entire investment as well. But with the share market, like we said at the start of the episode, you, with a single trade, with a tiny amount of money, you can get 2,000, 10,000 companies, whatever it may be, in those Vanguard diversified funds. And the one company going to zero literally has almost zero impact on your share portfolio. Even though the share market's more volatile, it's that level of diversification that gives you the confidence that it's going to grow over the long term, no matter what. But again, like, even if you go to what people would consider a well-diversified property portfolio with a few properties in some different states of Australia. Again, it's madness. Australia could go into a recession for 10 or 15 years, and you've still got all of your eggs essentially in one sort of smallish basket. Crazy. But I just wanted to mention that. It is close to impossible for the average person to achieve diversification in property in the same way that you can achieve diversification in shares.
It's almost the opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of concentration and diversification, isn't it?
Oh, it's nuts. It's nuts. When I'm in construction, so I know of all the weird and wonderful ways that construction can be done incorrectly and go wrong. owning that little diversification in your finances would be sickening.
Mm. All right, so let's just cover a bit of a summary of the most critical points that we've mentioned so far. So in Australia, buying investment property generally means taking on lots of debt. And it's really, if we're honest, it's really just a bet on growth and growth of house prices over time. And rents after all costs are involved are very low, even if the property's paid off. Funny thing, why do you think many established property investors end up starting a business like mortgage broking or become a buyer's agent? It's because they have absolutely no cash flow from their property portfolio. So they need to find some income from somewhere because they're probably reluctant to sell.
Yeah, well, they'd ruin their whole property owner image if they started selling them, wouldn't they?
Mm. I just thought that was an interesting point that I wanted to put in there. And so you'll be aware that if you do go down this route, you'll probably need to look at switching assets later to something where it's easier to generate income. I mean, with the share market, even if the yield is somewhat low, you can still, like, if you need some money, you can still, like, trim your shareholding to create some extra cash. But you can't really sell off the garage or sell off a bedroom to get some cash from your investment property. And then, of course, if you are switching assets later, again, we said that that means that you're up for a lot of costs, you know, capital gains tax and agents fees and all the rest of it. So that's another hurdle in your numbers to be aware of.
Mm.
So property's been an excellent performer over the long term, but I think both of us, Pat, feel like the future will be very different to the past. But at the end of the day, if you feel like that's all you're comfortable with and the share market is not for you, or you can do better than average from renovating houses by yourself in your spare time and things like that, then by all means, maybe property is the right path for you.
If it is all you're really comfortable with, then, you know, go for it. Better investing in something than nothing.
Well, some people are just, I really think some people, Pat, are just not going to be, they're just, I don't know, however much they read or whatever, I hear from other people that the share market is fine, they're just not going to be comfortable with it.
Yeah, fair enough. So we can probably go into some of the negatives of investing in the share market. So shares are really quite volatile. They need you to hold your nerve, sort of have a strong stomach. And even when things are falling, you can't sell in the share market. And in fact, you should be probably going against your gut instincts and continue buying. So we all like to think we'd have that strong stomach to keep doing that. But maybe a lot of us don't. And it's not until you're tested until you really find that out.
Hmm.
We kind of went through a little test, I'll say, at the start of this year. It wasn't a huge downturn, I'll say. And it wasn't very prolonged, or I don't think it's been very prolonged so far, but
it definitely wasn't prolonged. It bounced back, like, well, so far,
yeah, it's bounced back a little. It hasn't bounced back to where it was, but
I mean, would have been the biggest fall that both of us have invested through. It was 37%, I think, for the Aussie market.
Wow.
So that was quite decent.
Yeah.
I haven't experienced a larger fall than that. Have you?
No, I haven't. But it still wasn't very prolonged before it started bouncing. But maybe it'll drop again. I'm not sure.
Mm.
And so I'm sort of ready for that. But I am still buying because I don't know what the future brings. And shares, but they're the easiest to buy. They're the easiest to sell. They're the easiest to collect income from. And they're very simple to manage and diversify. And they, of course, still come with some tax benefits for the time being.
Another point is that I find that with shares, if you're starting and you're using just cash to fund your portfolio, you'll find that your progress will tend to be more reliable. And what I mean is every time you buy shares, your passive income increases, essentially. And every time you reinvest your dividends, your passive income will increase. Like every time you increase your ownership of this big basket of companies that you're buying, your passive income will grow each time. And so that's kind of a motivating force that kind of propels you along.
Yeah, I agree. It's great. And just even during a market downturn, just continuing to buy and continuing to think in that way, it's very powerful.
And if you are using that a cash only portfolio, it, because of the positive income you're receiving on a regular basis, and as the portfolio grows every year that passes, that passive income will be higher. So you essentially, you have more freedom with every year that passes, because you can choose to, oh, I'm getting $10,000 a year from my share portfolio now. Maybe I'll reduce one day at work a week or something like that. You know, it's way more flexible in that sense.
It's flexible, and you start to feel more free as you go along, to the point like where I am in my path toward financial independence. I do feel a lot more confident, even at work, ask for promotions, ask for extra money, speak my mind, because I know that I do have that buffer stop in the back in case I do, you know, do something stupid or say something stupid. But I am more confident to speak my mind these days than I used to be. And maybe part of that is the fact that I just have more experience now in my job as well. But I do like to think that part of that is because I have built this level of financial freedom.
Good point. So if we look at the actual asset class in comparison to each other, shares are generally superior. Property just tends to win on some people's calculations because of the massive leverage involved. But also, it's not as easy as it seems, and the numbers aren't as good as they seem from the things that we've discussed today. And those gains are far from guaranteed.
Mm. I think without leverage, the property market as it exists today wouldn't exist, you know. It'd still exist in some fashion. Maybe big corporates will come and buy up thousands of houses, and then you'd buy shares in them like a real estate investment trust or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we didn't have a huge... Well, it's going on that tangent, but if we didn't have a huge drop in interest rates, which facilitated a huge increase in household debt, prices would be a lot lower. And if prices were a lot lower, rental yields would be a lot higher. So property investing would probably make more sense in that regard, because you have a low growth asset but spits off decent cash flow. Maybe it does make sense. The numbers would look a lot different. And then, like you said, you would get corporates coming in because it would be like essentially like a real estate investment trust, which might collect thousands of houses or apartment buildings and then pay out a, you know, 6 or 7% distribution each year or something of the sort, you know?
Yeah.
But that's definitely not the world that we're living in, especially in Australia.
No. Okay, so I guess that's the end of our property talk. And if it wasn't obvious, Dave and I are extremely biased. I apologize that we couldn't deliver you a completely unbiased episode. Please don't attack us.
Yeah. Can anyone?
I don't know. Please don't attack us for it in the comments. At least we disclose our bias. And yeah, like you said, Dave, it's pretty hard not to be biased sometimes.
And I mean, hopefully, I mean, sometimes people will, like, you'll see some share market guys deriding the property market, but they've never invested in it. So I guess at least I have invested in it. So I have some experience. So it's not just two share market nuts who are just like, I hate property.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
So hopefully it's a little more credible that, you know, I've invested in it, I still own property, and I'm still willing to, I guess, speak out at some of the negatives that are, I guess, overlooked.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, so let's move on to our listener questions. So today we've got one listener question each. So we'll start with, Dave will ask me a question, I think.
All right, Pat. Yes, so this question came in, and it is, how did you become good with your money? I think I read somewhere that you're the son of immigrant parents. Can you share a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is true. I am the son of immigrant parents. They came here in their young 20s, and they started a life for themselves. And I'll say, or at least Steph likes to say that, you know, I may not have come from the richest household. When I was growing up, I never considered that I came from a not so well off household, because I always had everything I needed. You know, I always had a roof over my head. I always had food on the table, went to school like everyone else. But looking back on it, and especially comparing the way I grew up compared to some other people, you could say that I was sort of more lower middle class instead of higher middle class. And things like sharing bedrooms was the norm in my house as a child. And, you know, we didn't have music recitals or anything like that, where that might be more common these days. So I think I did build strong money habits out of that childhood and learned to save money, and saw that I had really hardworking parents that had to, sorry, I didn't actually mention this. I'm one of seven children. So both my parents.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, crazy, right? That surprises a lot of people. So both my parents had to work extremely hard just to keep that household going. And it's a really a bit difficult one for me to understand because I wouldn't say that all of my siblings grew up in the strongest financial sense, whereas I did. So I can't really explain that.
I think it's probably part, you know, that nature nurture thing, part nature, part nurture, like, you know, part of it's you and your own personality, and then part of it's your circumstances.
That's definitely it. And I suppose as I grew up, handouts were far and few in between, you know. As soon as I was able to, she was like 17 years old or something, I went out and got a job. And then I pretty much held a job part-time the whole way through the end of high school and through university. And even when I started my full-time career, I still did a few little gigs on the side because I was having fun doing them. Some of those part-time jobs. And it was very rare for, you know, apart from when I was young, my dad did give us a little bit of allowance. As soon as we got to an age where we could have a job, that was just cut off. And I was like, nah, you're old enough to earn your own money. Go out and do that. So
I actually think that's a good lesson to learn. Yeah. I actually think, it might sound strange, but I actually think it's better if children aren't handed things and they're learnt to work. They learn the value of money and what it means to achieve things for themselves and to save up and buy things for themselves. Because then they actually learn something. If you just give them something, what do they learn? They learn that, oh, I just get handed things. This is great.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the benefit there? What's the lesson?
I 100% agree. You have to teach your children the value of working for what you get. It can't just be a never-ending stream of handouts. Even if people get lost in the bushes a bit, they're like, oh, you know, I want to give my children every opportunity possible. They somehow, you know, spin this into, oh, I need to buy my children international travel and brand new cars. And it's, yeah, I can kind of see where they're coming from, but you need to make them work for it in some fashion. If you're going to buy them a car, then make them pay back some of it. You know, if you're like, if you need to get them a car to get to work so they can actually start earning an income because you don't really live near public transport, then sure, help them out, but make them pay it back or something. Jeez, teach them a lesson about shit that doesn't come free to your doorstep.
Mm-hmm. I think by doing that, like the never ending handouts thing, you're actually robbing them of learning valuable skills and achieving things and building their self-esteem for themselves that they can accomplish things as a young adult by themselves without needing, like that's, you can't. Like, you can't put a price on that.
No. And you just don't want them to be a brat, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're going to have a partner in the future, and you don't want them to deal with a piece of crap who just, you know, they need support as well. So think of your future son or daughter-in-law. Okay. So maybe that's, we'll ask you your question, Dave. Dave, your story is amazing. But I'm starting to form the view that people who retire early start in property and then move to shares. Do you agree with this?
Well, it's interesting. You do see that as an example occurring much more often than the other way around. In fact, I'm actually not aware of anyone starting in shares and then switching to property later. And I'm not sure if that's a coincidence, but I'm starting to think it's not. I'm starting to think that, yeah. Once people, I mean, you get to a certain stage with property, you realize that the income to retire is just not going to be there. I think it's more common. People start in property and they think, this is great. I understand it. I know, you know, what to expect. Property might go up over time. But then later, they might have built some wealth and it might actually work for them. But then they realize, well, this is actually hard to retire on. So maybe I should look at some other ways of generating some sort of cash flow. So that's probably when they start moving their savings towards the share market.
Mm.
But that's not the same thing as saying that that's what got them to retire early. You know, just because that's more common because of the comfort people have with property, that doesn't mean that property is what you need to retire early. And that definitely, I have a post about this on my blog called Our Adventures in Leveraged Property. And the numbers are actually worse than, I'm not sure how much numbers I put on the blog there, but over the last couple of years, the numbers have gotten a bit worse for our properties as time has passed and we've had no, I guess, additional returns and probably even losses. The point of that is that property wasn't really what got us to financial independence. If anything, looking back right now, we would have been better off in shares. I think when we first retired, the numbers would have worked out about the same, but after a couple more years, I think we would have been better in shares.
Yeah, wow.
So leverage can work, but it can also not work. I mean, like, there's no... There's nothing locked in there that said it's going to work.
And I suppose that's sort of the hidden agenda. Not purposefully hidden, but hidden agenda of this question is, do you need to start in property to get the capital growth and then move to shares for the income?
100% no.
No. Yeah.
100% no. Saving, like we've already covered, saving and investing as much as possible is the real secret here. And that maybe 3/4 of your nest egg or your capital over a decade or so will come from saving. And that's, I mean, our journey was a little bit shorter than that. So the percentage is probably even higher. Mm. And starting again, I mean, if that was the reason, if property was the reason, I would have no issue saying that, yes, property is the way to go. But I don't believe that. Mm. And if I was, I can honestly say, if I was starting again today, I would buy absolutely no property and I would start in shares and I would just keep it simple. It's a lot less hassle. It's a lot more reliable. Like I said, you're making constant progress, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. So I see that happening a bit, switching from property to shares, but I don't think that's correlated with the reason that people have retired early.
Yep. Yeah. And there's international bloggers and stuff which have already retired on a 100% share portfolio, you know, never owned property. And hopefully I'll be an example in the years to come very soon of just investing in shares the entire way and never owning investment properties.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I wish I had a clean story to tell you and, you know, this perfect chart of zero to, you know, whatever number and here's how I retired. But I don't have that kind of situation. It's a little bit messy. So unfortunately, I don't have that example to give.
Oh, well, we'll have one soon, hopefully.
Yeah.
All right. That's a wrap.
That's it for today?
Yes.
All right. Hope you enjoyed our chat/rant. By the way, you can see highlights and clips from the show on our YouTube channel. So if you just go on YouTube and search for Fire and Chill, that will come up straight away. Or you can find the link to our channel in the show notes. And thanks again for the positive reviews on Apple Podcasts. We really appreciate it. We're really blown away. Like, thank you so much, guys. And remember to submit a question for us to answer on the show. You can email us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com. Unfortunately, we can't answer all the emails because we get quite a few from our blog and through this channel now, but we do read them all and we try and break out the questions which will apply to the most amount of people. So that's pretty much it. So for more information on these topics, you can find the full show notes at our blogs, strongmoneyaustralia.com and lifelongshuffle.com. We'll talk to you soon.